case for the day, case number 2009-40373, Morgan versus Swanson.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Brandt. My partner Joshua Skinner and I represent Lynn Swanson, the principal of Thomas Elementary School, and Jackie Baumchill, the former principal of Razor Elementary School. As a preliminary matter, my clients would like to point out to the court that they denied engaging in any viewpoint discrimination against Christians. However, since this is an appeal of a motion to dismiss, the alleged facts are taken as true. Our point is that even under the alleged facts, both Baumchill and Swanson are entitled to qualified immunity. Age and context are key. What I would like to do is begin by focusing the court's attention on two things. One is Pearson versus Callahan, and the other is a little boy from New Jersey named Daniel Walls, the protagonist in Walls versus Egg Harbor.
I'm glad that you focused us on Pearson, assuming arguendo that Pearson would apply here. If we take a look at the different circuits that have opined on whether elementary school students have First Amendment rights, which is what you argue in your brief, that they, in fact, do not have First Amendment rights. Would you agree that the Fourth Circuit has opined that elementary schools have First Amendment rights?
Well, Your Honor,
would you agree with that, sir?
The Fourth Circuit in which decision?
In the Peck case and also child evangelism.
Yes.
Would you agree that the Third Circuit and Walker Serrano has opined that elementary school students have First Amendment religious rights or First Amendment rights?
Yes, Your Honor. The holdings in those cases are what they are. My
so
point
Pearson,
is...
So we're supposed to go circuit by circuit, right? That's what we're doing. So Third
yes.
Circuit, yes. Fourth Circuit, yes. Sixth Circuit has not, they've had an establishment clause case, hasn't specifically opined as far as I know. Are you aware that they've specifically opined one way or the other? They've also had a Hazelwood case where but have they officially opined one way or the other on whether elementary students have First Amendment rights in the abstract?
Your Honor, what we're trying to do in this case is not, we've asked the court to avoid the constitutional question and to address the qualified immunity.
Oh, yeah, but you've come right out and said, hey, elementary school kids do not have a First Amendment right. You said it.
Yes, and we also said in the brief,
And that's a pretty big statement, and I'd like to know where in the Constitution it says that.
No, we were focusing on a very
narrow...
That
we're going to give all these rights to people, but boy, they better not give them to kids.
Your Honor, what we were talking about, we were focusing on the narrowly focused argument that with regard to the distribution of non-curricular materials in the school day, there is no First Amendment protection for that.
You have to take the facts as you find them. And
yes.
It's during non-curricular time, student to student, not during a school time, not interfering with the school day. So you have to take the facts as you find them, don't you, counsel?
Yes, yes.
So it's not during curricular times distribution that could be maybe under the auspices, and it may be a trial, which you argue that it is, but that's not what we're here for on qualified immunity.
Well,
so can we continue our Pearson analysis? We've got Third Circuit and Fourth Circuit have opined that you do have First Amendment rights. Seventh Circuit in Mueller and in, I think, Baxter and something else has opined that they have First Amendment rights. Do you concur with that, counsel?
Yes.
Okay, 11th Circuit in Frazier has opined that elementary school students have First Amendment rights. Is that correct?
But Your Honor, with regard to the abstract general notion of rights, that's not what qualified immunity, that's not what Pearson says that we deal with.
Right,
what we deal with is the application of the specific right to this case and the facts of this case. If we talk about generalities, then it's true that Tinker says that they don't lose their rights at the courthouse door.
Okay,
that's not what we're trying to say.
Okay, counsel, in your brief you say neither this court nor the Supreme Court has ever upheld a First Amendment free speech claim by an elementary school student. The First Amendment is not implicated by restrictions on student-to-student distribution of non-curricular materials. You have teed up whether there is a First Amendment right in elementary school for elementary school kids. And that's what you teed up in your first argument. So we haven't quite finished our Pearson. So we've done 3rd, 4th, 7th, 11th. Have we missed 10th? We've missed 10th. The 10th Circuit has also opined that elementary students don't give up their First Amendment rights, haven't they, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any other circuit that has opined on this issue that I've omitted, either pro or against First Amendment rights for elementary students?
Well, the Third Circuit, in the Walls versus Egg Harbor case, they said that there was no First Amendment right at issue there. It was a remarkably similar fact.
Well, actually, that's not what it says. I mean, that case actually says they do have First Amendment rights. However, under these particular facts, it was subscribed appropriately. But it wasn't, that case could have been two sentences long. Elementary school children do not have First Amendment rights, period, thank you very much. And they would be done. They don't need the whole analysis they have there if that's the answer. So, I mean, your argument is, well, this is just so flaky, we can't figure it out, and therefore there's always going to be qualified immunity. I mean, your argument taken to its logical conclusion, not even extreme, is there is always going to be qualified immunity for school officials because First Amendment rights in elementary school students, whatever they may be, are so flaky and hard to figure out that there can be no way it's clearly established and no way that they can not have qualified immunity. That's your argument.
My argument comes directly from Morse, exactly, and from Pearson. Morse, in Justice Breyer's concurrence, talks about how that decision, if it had been qualified immunity, it would have been unanimous. And then Clarence Thomas, in the Morse decision, he opines that they don't have First Amendment rights at all.
So is there ever going to be a situation where a school official can be held liable for violating an elementary student's First Amendment rights under your analysis? Or are you saying it's so flaky, they're always going to have qualified immunity?
There certainly could be facts that I could think up where there would be some way in which you hold it liable at this point. But what I'm saying is, under the facts of this case, the allegations of this case, that it was not clearly established. If at the time that Swanson and Bombshell were acting, if they had gotten a lawyer and said, look up the case law, they would have found the most factually similar case was Walls versus Egg Harbor. And the reading of Walls, the district court said there was no violation of Daniel Walls' rights, none. And that had to do with the candy cane and the message attached to it and the pencils, the Christian pencils. The superintendent there said, no, you can't do that. You can't pass them out. And he was worried about an Establishment Clause violation, which is a reasonable worry given what this circuit has said about the Establishment Clause jurisdiction being rife with confusion. That was the Freiler decision. And what happened at the...
This is an Establishment Clause case, counsel?
It has been pled. One of the pleadings in this case by the plaintiffs is an Establishment Clause claim. But what I'm saying is that...
Who's the speaker?
The speaker is the child. But... that's a good question.
Clause.
That's a very good question.
Thank
because
you.
Because with regard to... Who is the speaker? There's a fair question as to whether this is parents who are speaking through their children or whether it's the parent or the child speaking itself.
Are the parents administrators or teachers or somehow an authority figures at the school such that the imprimatur of the school would be put on the parents? If the speaker's this parent or the child, either one, it's not an Establishment Clause case, is it, counsel?
There are other parents and other students that are in the classroom who are going to be those other children are going to be obtaining this written material from these students, and those other parents have not given their approval to have their children receive these materials.
Okay, but I mean, if there was a child passing out Metallica concert tickets at the elementary school, there might be parents who would disapprove of their 6-year-old going to such a concert. However, the school wouldn't have stopped that.
Well, it would have.
We don't have any evidence to that effect. We have evidence, as you've spotted us, that it was content-based. It was because it was a Christian event. You haven't said you're never allowed to distribute any concert tickets, whether it's a patriotic song or it's a Metallica concert or it's a Christian festival. You've stipulated, as you have to for purposes of where we are here, that it was content-based, that it's because it's a Christian concert. So Metallica's okay, Christian not.
Well...
You haven't said that anything that could offend any parent anywhere in the universe is what we prohibited. It was specifically Christian materials.
Well, the policy that was in effect at the time did require materials to be submitted ahead of time, and also had certain categories of materials that would not be allowed to be distributed. It's not as if that was anything goes, and that they had certainly not created any kind of a public forum in doing this. And what was going on, and what the case law makes clear, is that these in-school parties that are going on are curricular in nature.
But you have to take the facts as in the complaint, and in the complaint, it's non-curricular. Don't you have to live with that at this point?
Not under Twombly and not under Iqbal.
You're stuck with the facts as pled that it's non-curricular.
Not under Twombly. The Supreme Court has said what's plausible under motions to dismiss.
It's not plausible that a party is non-curricular?
It's not plausible for anyone who knows anything about education or has been administrative education of elementary school students. It is a teaching moment. When you are in an in-school party, you are learning what the Supreme Court and other courts have recognized, that the children are learning more than simply the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. They're learning how to obey, how to be quiet.
They're learning to be ashamed to use the word Christian.
No,
you're on Christmas. Yes, that's what you've had to stipulate to, that Christmas is not something they're allowed to say either, and write in a note to the troops.
Well, Your Honor, what...
So, you know, that's what they're being taught going the other way. So, yeah, I understand the concern about not having children proselytizing under the aegis of the school, but I also understand the concern about making children ashamed of how they believe.
Your Honor, this is not about a particular religion. It happens to be under the facts that it was the Christian religion. But if it were any other religion, it would...
Well, I'd be equally concerned if it was Buddhism. It's not based
right,
on what
but it...
But it is a concern that a religious message is what everybody's jumping on, and not just any message under the sun, as was the case in Walls. In Walls, you couldn't have brought in Joe's plumbing pencils and handed them out. In your school, they could have.
Your Honor, you're right that we had to take the facts as they're pled. But under Twombly, under the new motion dismiss standard, it has to be plausible. And what I'm saying to you is that in the curricular environment of this party, it truly is a teaching moment. It is something that the school administrators have to have control over. And whether they control the flow of information, regardless of what source it's from, they're in control. And even under Tinker and all the other cases that have come back, they have recognized that the importance of the school administrators having control, that the federal courts aren't going to come in and run the schools and undermine the authority of the principals or the teachers or the other school administrators.
Okay, but under that theory, we just basically don't have jurisdiction over school cases.
No, Your Honor.
I mean, if we're not going to interfere when somebody isn't allowed to say Christmas, then when are we going to interfere? I mean, that's the question.
No,
and we clearly have some jurisdiction. I agree. We don't want to sit around and be school administrators.
Yes.
But that would argue that we have no role here.
What I said earlier was age and context is the key. Tinker applied to high school. Most of the cases out there that have gone to the Supreme Court have dealt with high school students. And there has been a general trend to say, well, you know, the marketplace of ideas concept applies somewhat in high school because these are children who are reaching the age of maturity and they're going to enter into the marketplace of ideas very shortly. That analogy does not apply. It's less appropriate in the elementary school context when what they're supposed to be learning is how to orderly get through the lunch line without distributing pencils.
Yeah, but you've had to...
Can you give us a case that has said just what you said?
The Mueller case is a very good case that talks about that.
Where is Mueller from?
Mueller is...
it's not from this circuit.
No, it's not. This circuit has been silent on this issue.
Okay.
But the Mueller decision... I'm sorry, let me get it for you real quick.
Seventh Circuit.
That one was a very good case because it talked about the difference between the traditional approach to education and this new approach that Tinker applied, which was the old approach was in loco parentis, seeing the school as a substitute for the parent. The
and
Tinker.
I would say the great majority of parents of elementary school children think that the teacher is.
Yes, and they also, I would submit, expect the teacher to behave in loco parentis,
right.
Which means that they expect this to be a neutral zone where they're not allowing, the teacher is not allowing.
I don't know where, I've seen any case that talks about neutrality on any issue as being a factor of loco parentis.
Well, the established, my time is out, Your Honor, but in answer to your question, the Establishment Clause jurisdiction does talk about neutrality.
The Establishment Clause is one of the aspects of the religious freedom in the First Amendment. The Free Exercise Clause is right there next to it, and that's the one that is becoming more and more at issue in deciding when and where and how religion can be brought into the marketplace.
My time is up.
When you come back, will you discuss the Mueller case? Because I thought the Mueller case says that nothing requires censoring the fourth graders' leaflets, and that elementary schools do have free exercise rights. So you want to rely on it, and I know you want to make a point about it, so I'm going to hear you on that point.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Because it doesn't appear to support your position in my reading of the case.
May it please the court, I am Charles Bunder, and I represent the families from the Plano Independent School District, the Morgans and the Verschers. I will address the court for 13 minutes as to the issues that are raised in the appellant's brief. Co-counsel representing the amici, the Barnett sisters, Mr. Paul Clement, will address the court for 7 minutes on the issues raised in the Barnett brief on the amici.
Are they right about Twombly that we can't say that these are non-curricular times?
No, they're not, Your Honor. And in fact, the very, very detailed complaint, which is in the record, First Amendment complaint, which is in this record, details the specific facts. The court is also correct. Judge Haynes is correct, and you are correct, Your Honor, that this is really a viewpoint discrimination case. It's not just content. It is viewpoint. They have admitted that they engaged in viewpoint discrimination directed at religion, specifically the Christian religion. The district court and the report and recommendation from Magistrate Judge Bush analyzed it under viewpoint discrimination.
Okay, so they could pass out pencils that said Joe's Plumbing or,
Moon, which they did,
or down with X or Y or up with X or Y, as long as it wasn't religion.
Or I support Obama's health care or I don't support Obama's health care. But when it mentions religion.
Okay, so it could even be a political pencil, so and so for president.
It can't be a religious pencil. It cannot be a religious message. And that's what this case is about. This is viewpoint discrimination. They have admitted viewpoint discrimination, but they argue that they are permitted to engage in viewpoint discrimination because of the age of the children. There is no support in the circuits and no support, obviously, in the Supreme Court for such a novel argument.
I mean, what do you do with the specter that they're presenting is parents standing around with their lawyers on speed dial waiting for some administrator to make a misstep, and they're like, aha, we got you, now we're going to sue you because you didn't quite follow all of these Supreme Court cases and Fifth Circuit cases and 6th and 7th and 10th. How do you respond to that?
There's nothing in the record to support that. And in fact, the record supports that the parents went in for a prior meeting with the principal. Doug Morgan went in to meet with the principal to talk with Principal Swanson about the upcoming party and that they intended on distributing the Legend of the Candy Cane religious message. These parents were proactive in meeting with the administrators before their children were engaged in the distribution of these materials. Stephanie Verscher met with Principal Bombchill in her office and presented her with two pencils, one that said Moon, one that had a religious inscription on it. She allowed the Moon pencil. She did not allow the religious inscription, and in fact, later that day, took those pencils out of the daughter's hand on the lawn. This is viewpoint discrimination.
And Claire, I mean, what about the concert? Is there any evidence that they wouldn't allow any concert?
Your Honor, there's plenty of evidence, but for purposes of this appeal, we have alleged viewpoint discrimination. They have admitted viewpoint discrimination. That's not an issue.
Okay,
here.
So we have to assume they would have allowed a Metallica concert, but not
that's
a Christian
correct,
concert.
Your Honor.
The tickets to be distributed.
Because we alleged in our complaint facts in which they have allowed other distribution of other items that are not religious items in the school. And they have done that. But for purposes of this appeal on qualified immunity, the fact is that we have viewpoint discrimination here. They have admitted it. They admitted it in their brief. The magistrate judge analyzed it under viewpoint discrimination. And of course, as this court is well aware from the Chu opinions, Chu 1 and Chu 2, from 2001 and 2003, in which I argued to this court, viewpoint discrimination is per se unlawful. That is not an excuse. And in fact, the Establishment Clause, which they attempt to argue, is not an excuse. The Supreme Court in the Good News versus Milford case was faced with religious viewpoint discrimination against children ages 6 to 12.
Counsel, does this appeal involve in any way regulation of what can be done in the curricular day?
It does not.
That the government can't regulate for school reasons?
It does not involve in any way a Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier analysis or a curricular analysis. The district court looked at that issue. This is not curricular. This is viewpoint discrimination. The simple question before this court that they have raised in their brief, and as the court has correctly characterized, they teed it up, is they want to engage in viewpoint discrimination against these children because they attend elementary school.
So you're not asking us to hold that elementary students can run amok and that they have, rights that trump any kind of educational purpose and that they have, that they should be treated exactly the same as high school students and able to talk constantly or run around as they see fit at the school, are you?
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. That is not our argument. We have never made that argument. We recognize and respect instructional time. We recognize and respect curricular time. But
what about this argument, though, that the kids, elementary school kids, can't tell the difference between their teacher getting up and preaching a particular religion and a fellow student handing them a pencil that says Jesus is the reason for the season?
That argument was made before the Supreme Court in Good News versus Milford. That was exactly the argument that the school district made there, that the students would perceive the religious activities occurring at school as being endorsed. The court, in an opinion 6-3 in Good News, said, we are unpersuaded. They specifically rejected that. They had previously rejected the same perception argument in Mergens. It had been rejected in Widmar versus Vinson in the university setting. But in the Good News setting, this was an elementary school with ages 6-12. The Good News decision was decided in 2001, which was prior to the events that occurred here. These officials were on fair warning, both from Chu 1 and Chu 2 and from Good News.
Well, what about this idea, though, that if these principals had gone to if they had a lawyer on speed dial and called him or her, that person would have said, oh, the Walls case just came out, you're cool, candy canes can't be passed out, everything's fine, you're doing the right thing, keep doing what you're doing. What about that?
Walls, like Curry, Your Honor, was analyzed under Hazelwood versus Tinker. It was part of the curriculum. It was part of the classroom instruction. In Curry, it was part of a city that they had created.
Yeah, I mean, Curry, I understand, but Walls is a little closer to your party.
A little closer, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But in Walls, and it's a very important distinction for Walls, and the court is correct, in Walls, and I have the opinion here, they said elementary students retain certain First Amendment rights of expression. They did recognize the rights of elementary school students. The reason that they did not allow the distribution in Walls is because it was a Hazelwood versus Tinker analysis, and they analyzed it under Hazelwood versus Tinker as being part of the school curriculum. One important distinction in Walls is that the gifts were donated to the parent-teacher organization, and it was the parent-teacher organization that actually distributed the gifts at the party, not the students. That's not the situation here.
And am I correct that they didn't allow, a X for president kind of pencil either in Walls? In other words, it was not only religion that was prohibited.
I think that's correct,
Your
Honor.
It was any kind of commercial message.
I think that you are correct in that, Your Honor. But the important thing is that Walls, the plaintiffs in the Walls case did not plead viewpoint discrimination. So there was no analysis of viewpoint discrimination in Walls, whereas here there is clear viewpoint discrimination, both in our complaint, in the magistrate judge's findings that were adopted by the district court, and even in the admission from the principals here that they engaged in viewpoint discrimination.
What say you about Justice Breyer's concurrence in Morse regarding qualified immunity?
It's a concurrence. It's not an opinion of the court.
But it's a pretty confident concurrence.
It is a concurrence. The same as I would say about Justice Thomas's dissent in Morse, it is a single opinion. It is not the opinion of the court. The opinion of the court is found in Justice Alito's and Justice Kennedy's opinion, as this court has already recognized in the Ponce decision. That is the controlling opinion of the court in Morse. That opinion, the Kennedy-Alito opinion, was analyzed under Tinker. And Tinker, subsequent to the Tinker decision in Bethel versus School Frazier, they analyzed Tinker as a viewpoint case. So we come back to the same issue that we have here, which is the question before the court is whether or not school officials who engage in viewpoint discrimination against a religious viewpoint are entitled to qualified immunity simply because they did it against elementary school students.
Oh, okay, I found the quote from Walls I was looking for. According to your colleague over there, Mr. Clement, school prohibited gifts with commercial, political, religious, or other undertones that promoted a specific message. So that would tell me that Joe's Plumbers also couldn't have pencils there.
They didn't discriminate.
So it was not viewpoint on religion. It was any, you just can't have a message.
That's correct,
John. Moon, Joe's Plumber, anybody. So-and-so for president.
Yeah. Walls was clearly not a viewpoint discrimination case. They don't even mention viewpoint discrimination. They don't even discuss Good News versus Milford, which is, I believe, the leading Supreme Court opinion dealing with this situation.
Should we be at all concerned with the fact that all of this litigation might cause schools to just close down, become closed shops all the way around, not allow anything in, just so that they can try to save their harried teachers and principals a lot of grief?
As a public policy matter, Your Honor, I don't believe the court should be concerned with that. There is sufficient.
It's not our job.
It's not your job, Your Honor. You, as Justice Haynes says, you are not the school board. So we'll allow the school boards to make those decisions. The school boards are, however, subject to the Bill of Rights. And that was clear in West Virginia versus Barnett, which has been the law of this land for over 50 years. I'm going to let Mr. Clement address that issue more fully because he's fully capable of doing so, and I don't want to carry any water for Mr. Clement. So,
okay, I'm still concerned about this. It's not plausible that it's not curricular. This is, you know, opposing counsel says in elementary school it's not plausible that it's not curricular. I guess that means going out to the parking lot, handing out this to your friend as well. Is curricular, but I think that's in the record.
Your Honor, that is part of the argument that Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy rejected in Morse. That goes to the argument, the educational mission argument, which the Supreme Court has said is not a sufficient justification for denying First Amendment rights. Simply because my speech or the student's speech is not part of the school's agenda or part of their educational mission does not allow the school to therefore censor or to restrict the distribution of that message. So that has been rejected by the Supreme Court. I see the argument kind of as a gloss in the appellant's brief, all the way through the brief, that it's educational mission. It was rejected, and it's not part of our jurisprudence in the First Amendment speech clause area. The fair warning that was given to these officials clearly comes from CHU 1 and CHU 2. CHU 1 and CHU 2 clearly held that viewpoint discrimination by school officials of the same school district, principals of the same school district, is unlawful. And it made no exceptions based upon the age. Subsequent to that, and in the middle of that.
Why does Plano seem to have so many issues? I know, I'm serious. They show up as the defendant in a lot of these cases. So.
Your Honor, that would not be a legal response if I gave you that. But
okay.
That's
fair. It's not in the record?
It's not in the record.
All right. That's fair.
We'll stick to the record. That is not in the record, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired, and I will yield to Mr. Clement. We urge the court to affirm the district court's decision that viewpoint discrimination is impermissible, even if you are discriminating against children in elementary school.
Your Honors, Paul Clement, I represent the Barnett sisters. My clients, perhaps understandably, had thought that the proposition that elementary school students had First Amendment rights was clearly established over 60 years ago. After all, their own First Amendment rights were vindicated by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1943 in the decision of West Virginia against Barnett. Now, appellants have attempted to diminish the clarity of that ruling by suggesting that the court wasn't fixated on the fact that they were elementary school students. Now, I would suggest at the outset that that's good evidence that the fact that they were elementary school students was irrelevant. Nonetheless, the court did refer to them as, quote, little children, and equally revealingly, I think, the case that the Supreme Court overruled in Barnett, Gabaitis, specifically referenced the students there being 10 and 12 years old. So I don't think there's any suggestion whatsoever that the Barnett decision did not involve elementary school students.
And actually, that's an interesting point. There is a huge difference between a 6-year-old and a 12-year-old, but they can both be in elementary school.
No, that's very much the case, Your Honor. And in fact, of course, the facts of this case stretch from essentially a first grade holiday party to fifth grader Stephanie Varsher, who's trying to distribute tickets to an Easter drama in the context of after school time. So, I mean, you really have kind of the gamut of students here and also conduct. And I really don't understand how the allegation that Stephanie Varsher's activities, for example, after class in distributing these tickets was not plausibly non-curricular. It seems to me, in fact, calling that curricular would be the implausible move in this case. And so it's
you're saying there's no way the fifth graders could misunderstand that that's just her passing out the tickets as opposed to the school saying you ought to go to the Easter concert or drama or whatever?
I think there's absolutely no risk of endorsement, and I think there's absolutely no risk of the conclusion that this is somehow a classroom instruction that's going on at this particular time. So I think in both those ways, it's completely distinguishable.
Opposing counsel tries to distinguish Tinker by saying that Hope and Paul Tinker were not parties to the appeal. Is that correct as a factual matter?
It's correct that Paul and Hope were not parties to the appeal. It's also a fact that Justice Black essentially starts his dissent by talking about the fact that they too were wearing armbands, and essentially Justice Black makes the point that the Supreme Court, by recognizing the First Amendment rights of school children, is going to unleash the First Amendment from kids from kindergarten to 12th grade.
And so nobody dropped a footnote in the majority opinion that said, oh, wait, his dissent is not well-founded because it doesn't apply in this way.
No, not a word of the majority opinion responds to that aspect of the dissent or attempts to say that the dissent is really sort of tilting at windmills here because we're not saying anything about elementary school students. Would have been hard for the court to do that in Tinker, of course, because it was relying on cases like Meyer against Nebraska that unambiguously involved grammar school students. So,
did it overrule an elementary speech case? Tinker expressly overruled an elementary speech case where they had restricted speech as part of the Tinker decision?
They may have, Your Honor. I'm not remembering that. What I am remembering is that when they cite the various cases that support the court's resolution of Tinker, they basically start with Meyer against Nebraska, which of course was an effort to restrict the rights of students in a grammar school that went up to eighth grade. So I really think this idea that somehow, that when the court all these years has been saying that the First Amendment doesn't stop at the schoolhouse gate, that what they meant was that the First Amendment doesn't start until junior high school, I just don't think there's any way to make that argument work, Your Honor.
Well, that's an interesting point. I guess you could have a one-school-fits-all situation where first through 12th are in a small town, in the same schoolhouse. I mean, we're thinking of urban and suburban areas where they tend to be separated, but you're right, they could be in the same schoolhouse.
No, and the Barnett sisters were not in the proverbial one-room schoolhouse, but they were in a very small school where grades kind of 1 through 6 were all basically within a couple of classrooms. So I think that really was the situation that the court itself confronted in the Barnett decision. If I could talk about just two courts of appeals decisions. One, the Waltz case has already been discussed a great deal. And to answer your question, Judge Haynes, about what would the school board lawyer do with the call and the hypothetical question about, well, you know, we got this Waltz case. I think the first thing that the school board attorney would do if they were doing their job is say, okay, well, Waltz is a great decision. Now, you didn't engage in any viewpoint discrimination here, did you? Because the one thing that's clear from all these cases is that viewpoint discrimination is absolutely verboten. So as long as you didn't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint, boy, yeah, Waltz is a pretty good decision. But I think that's the first thing that they would say, because that is a fundamental category difference maker in First Amendment law.
And so in Waltz, by saying you can't have any message of any sort, then that's not viewpoint discrimination. We're saying you can't have a religious message is, even if you don't distinguish, even if you don't say, well, you can have a Jewish message but not a Christian message, or you can have a Christian message but not a Buddhist message.
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, the court has made clear that discrimination against religious speech is a viewpoint discrimination. It is not a content-based discrimination.
No, I'm not arguing that.
Right.
I'm
no,
clarifying
exactly. That's,
that.
That's Rosenberger. Okay. So that's absolutely clear.
So the school can, in your view, prohibit you just can't have anything on the pencil. If you're going to hand out a pencil, it's got to be blank. But they can't say, well, but you can have Joe's Plumbing, but you can't have so-and-so for president, and you can't have Jesus is the reason for the season, and you can't have whatever.
Well, I would say at a minimum that's a very different case. You still might want to make an inquiry whether it's pretextual. I mean, if the only reason they adopted the no-pencil policy is because they really wanted to get rid of the Jesus pencils, I mean, that is still problematic state action. But that's not the case we have here. Here, as the case comes to you, it's a valid discrimination on the basis of religion. And so that's why I think Waltz you can really put to one side for that important reason. The other case, just to mention, and I know it's going to come up in rebuttal, is the Mueller case. I'd make two points about the Mueller case. One is there is a section of that opinion, part two, that does cast doubt on whether or not elementary school students should have First Amendment rights. The interesting thing, though, is that that part two of the opinion was joined by neither other judge in the panel. So nobody wanted to join that proposition. The second thing that's equally revealing is that before the district court in that case, there was both an as-applied challenge that involved viewpoint discrimination and a challenge to the policy that was more neutral on its face. The school district in that case didn't even appeal the adverse as-applied finding. They only appealed on the policy itself. And it's that as-applied case that is really analogous to what you have here. And what you have here is viewpoint discrimination, and the law on that is clearly established.
Counsel, can you opine about Justice Thomas's views in the Morris case, which apparently the opposing counsel believe are very important because they lead off the brief?
Well, they did indeed, and I certainly think that whatever ambit there is for school officials, it doesn't extend so far that if one justice of the Supreme Court taking what is admittedly a distinct and counter-majoritarian view supports their case. I mean, if they do, we're in a lot of trouble because Justice Thomas, God love him, is also willing to reconsider Calder v. Bull, which the Supreme Court decided in 1798 and nobody's thought twice about since.
Thank you.
Moving beyond Walls for a moment, other circuits that have held, that are significant to the qualified immunity aspect, and granted, this is a qualified immunity appeal. And for the court to deny qualified immunity under the prior rigid Saussure order of battle would have had to have addressed both issues, the constitutionality and the clearly established. What we're saying here is that it is not clearly established. The only way that you can affirm the district court is for you to address the constitutionality issue and find that there was a constitutional issue. What we're focusing on is the clearly established issue. Curry, district court opinion, says there's a hazy border that divides acceptable from unreasonable conduct. The appellate decision in
Curry. But don't you have to be at that hazy border? In other words, if we accept that there might be something that's very clear that you cannot do as a school principal and something very clear that you can do, there's always going to be something in between, a little hazy border, as you call it. And if you're standing on the hazy border, maybe that's what qualified immunity is all about. But if you are way over here saying you can never use the word Christmas, no way, no how, as long as you're on school premises, that doesn't seem all that hazy to me.
Well, Your Honor, going back to the basics of qualified immunity and the fair warning that it requires fair warning akin to the warning that criminal defendants get of vague criminal laws. There can't be a criminal law that says thou shalt not do bad things and then you throw somebody in jail because they did a bad thing. You have to be specific about it. That same reasoning applies to qualified immunity. And if you've got courts all over, and we've cited in our brief, where they're saying, gee, I'm scratching my head about this one, and the Walls case comes out and it seems to be factually on board, and yet lawyers can distinguish the two by really parsing it out, what the general message to public officials would be was, okay, you can keep candy canes out, okay, you can keep Christian pencils out. That would be the message that was received. It wouldn't be clearly established that they say, okay, well, if a lawyer or a judge can distinguish the case, then that hypothetical about Swanson and Bombshell talking to their lawyer and saying, hey, what about this Walls case? That's, in a sense, not what qualified immunity is about. Qualified immunity is about clear lines. If there's a clear line, what's that?
How does Curry help your position? Because this is that Classroom City case.
Yes.
And in that Classroom City case, it was Classroom City. It's clearly curricular, and we have to assume this is non-curricular. And Curry goes to a great, tries to distinguish the Tinker situation from the Hazelwood situation, and says, private expression of elementary school students is protected by the First Amendment under Tinker. It seems to me if you read Curry, you would say that you didn't have qualified immunity rather than that you do.
When I read Curry, Your Honor, I see a couple of things. First of all, it says to me that elementary school students do not have a First Amendment right to promote an unsolicited religious message during an organized curricular activity.
Right. There's no Number organized two, curricular activity here, and that's the key point of this case.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because I think that the curricular activity of the in-class, if this is during school hours, it's in the classroom, it's a school-sponsored in-class party.
But what about handing out the concert tickets? How is that, or the Easter drama, or whatever, how is that possibly any different than the little kid coming in and saying, you know, I've got these tickets to the movies this weekend and my parents were going out of town. Do you want them? Here, Jennifer, do you want these tickets? And I hand them to my friend. How is that different from, hey, I've got tickets to the Easter drama at church. Do you want them?
Two children in the classroom passing a note is not what we're talking about here.
Well, isn't that exactly what we're talking about? It's one child standing at the bus stop or something on the way outside. Is that
No, Your Honor, no. Respectfully, what has happened is everything except for one incident of the four incidents that my clients are accused of, everything happened in a classroom.
It happened at the exit.
At the exit door where people are ingress and egress.
Oh, my God.
That's where...
What's the difference between the exit or on the way out? I'm sorry.
The doors that they're leaving for the day, and this is a matter of order and discipline and keeping people moving along. That's why an earlier panel of this Fifth Circuit said that the distribution at lunchtime was, the restrictions on those distributions was constitutional. It recognized the plain common sense idea that the classroom involves the hallways and also the cafeteria.
Okay, but then that's a different issue. That's not viewpoint. That's saying I couldn't hand out the tickets to the, you know, General Cinema this weekend either. It's not I can't hand them out to the Christian event, but I can hand them out to the just general movie theater or to Alice in Wonderland or whatever.
I'm sorry, my time is up.
No, please.
But I'm glad
you answered the question.
All right, this distinction is, Your Honor, that in this case, yes, we have had to take the allegations as they're pled because it's a motion to dismiss. But the reality is different than what we have to address here. The reality is that, as I said at the outset, my clients deny that they engaged in any of this discrimination of any sort. And we have all tried to avoid the depositions of many children, all the children that were there in the classroom. The decision on both sides was to try to avoid that. So we tee up the issue and we try to figure out, is this clearly established? And the cases that I've cited to, Your Honor, I think hold for the proposition that the law is in somewhat of disarray, such that that clear line, that fair warning that is borrowed from the criminal statutes, was not available. We shouldn't let public school teachers be subject to compensatory and punitive damages from their own pocket about things that are not clearly established.
Is there any case in all of America that has held that religious viewpoint discrimination against school children is appropriate?
Your Honor, in the cases that we've cited, and we've cited many, the one thing, in Judge Luttig's...
Not because of viewpoint, not because of curriculum, but because
Yes. Well, Your Honor, and there were several, actually.
What case holds?
Well, the Peck case is one that we were talking about, that Justice Luttig talked about in a footnote star, that he thinks the Supreme Court might require viewpoint discrimination in public elementary schools.
So is that a case that holds that viewpoint discrimination against religious people is appropriate? Or is that just a passing intellectual footnote of some interest?
Well, I think it's more than a passing intellectual interest. What you have here is justices, very well-respected justices, Posner talking in the Brandt case, you have Luttig talking, they're all talking.
Is there a single case in all of American history holding that religious viewpoint discrimination is okay?
In the Neuer case, Neuer versus Whitehead, I would point you to that decision, Your Honor. It's a Ninth Circuit decision. It's in our brief.
Thank you very much. The court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow. Thank you.